Welcome to the Superstars of Astronomy podcast from Astronomy Magazine. I'm Dave Eicher, Editor-in-Chief of Astronomy. Each month, I will share the thoughts and research of the world's greatest astronomers, astrophysicists, cosmologists, and planetary scientists with you in these hour-long chats. Superstars of Astronomy is brought to you by Celestron. From your first telescope to precision observatory-grade instruments, Celestron has the perfect telescope to suit your experience level and budget. Find out more at celestron.com. I'm delighted to have as our 11th guest in this series a very distinguished astronomer, Martin Rees, Lord Rees of Ludlow. Professor Rees is a fellow of Trinity College and emeritus professor of cosmology and astrophysics at the University of Cambridge. He is Astronomer Royal of the United Kingdom, is a past president of the Royal Society, and is the recipient of numerous awards. He is author or co-author of more than 500 research papers, mainly on astrophysics and cosmology, has delivered numerous important lectures, and has written 8 books, including Our Final Century, Gravity's Fatal Attraction, and What We Still Don't Know. Lord Rees' research covers a wide variety of topics, including high-energy astrophysics, focusing on gamma-ray bursts, the nuclei of galaxies, the formation of black holes, and radiative processes, including gravitational waves. He also studies cosmic structure formation, including the early generation of galaxies and stars that formed after the cosmic dark age. In 2005, Rees was appointed to the English House of Lords. Recently, he's been active as a proponent of Asteroid Day. So without further ado, Lord Rees, thank you so much for joining me today.
It's very good to be in this series.
Thank you. And let's jump right in. We have so much, and you're such an expert in so many fields here. We have lots to talk about. Let me start, though, with a fairly basic question, if I may. What was it that got you interested in astronomy to begin with?
Well, I wasn't one of those people who knew right from early childhood what I wanted to do. In fact, when I was a kid, I was interested in science and numbers, and I proved to be quite good at math. And therefore, when I went to university, that's what I specialized in. But I realized that I wasn't really enjoying it very much. I wanted to apply it to something else. And I didn't quite know what to do. I thought quite seriously of doing economics. But in my fourth year, I did master's level courses and did some on astrophysics and cosmology. And then I was taken on at Cambridge University as a graduate student in astrophysics. And my best piece of luck, really, was that I was assigned to Dennis Sharma, who was one of the faculty members, and he was my PhD advisor, and he was a very charismatic person, and he had a stable of good students already, and Stephen Hawking had started 2 years earlier,
yes,
working with him, and there were others. And so after a year of working with him, I was sure I was doing a good thing. And of course, it was a good time, because this was 1965 we're talking about, which was when the microbacca was discovered, the first quasars, etc. So it was a good time for young people, because when things are changing fast, the experience of the old guys is at a heavy discount, and new people can make an impact fairly quickly.
And this was really a tremendous psychological push from the discovery of the microwave background, and you found yourself at perhaps the most spectacular place to be research-wise at that time. What was that sort of a golden age, a golden moment in your development, and what was it like to work with and around such a stellar cast of both senior professors and of younger, brilliant talent at that time?
Well, of course, I was lucky, and it was a good time in astronomy, but for any younger listeners, I would say it's just as good now. There's just as much happening now, so there was nothing all that special about the 1960s. But I was very lucky to be in Cambridge, because it was a place where there had been a lot going on in astronomy and theory, and Fred Hoyle, who had been a professor there for a decade or more, was the most creative astronomy in the world, in my opinion, over that period. And there was a big debate about whether there was Big Bang at all, whether the universe was in a steady state. The steady state theory was developed back in 1948 by Fred Hoyle, Herman Bondi, and Tommy Gold.
Yes.
And they were three very lively and articulate people. And they got that theory taken very seriously. It wasn't taken very seriously in the US or in the Soviet Union, but it was a big issue in the UK. And of course, until the early 1960s, there was no way to shoot it down because it predicted that the universe would have looked the same at all times. And you could only disprove that if you could look back far enough to an era when it might have been different. And only in the early 60s was it possible to get evidence at a sufficiently early time to refute the steady state theory by showing that the galaxies were not the same in the past as they are now. 5 billion years earlier, they were different. And of course, we had in 1965 the evidence of the micro background, which was very quickly accepted by almost everyone as evidence of the universe's hot, dense beginning. Fred Hoyle, incidentally, never came round to believing that. He stuck with the steady state and eventually compromised with what I call a steady bang theory, which he never really reconciled himself. Dennis Sharma was actually one of the enthusiasts for the steady state theory. He wrote a book called The Unity of the Universe. He described himself as the most fervent advocate of the steady state theory, apart from its three inventors. But he shifted and became a real zealot for the Big Bang theory. He was someone who liked to believe something strongly, but he shifted to the Big Bang fairly suddenly in the mid-1960s.
And you were enamored with cosmology early on at Cambridge there with everything that was happening and with your association with Dennis, presumably.
Well, that's right, although my PhD was mainly about the physics of quasars, because the other new discovery at that time was quasars, which were mysterious. It wasn't clear at that time that they were just the hyperactive centers of galaxies, but the problem was that they were far more luminous than the normal galaxy, but much more compact from the evidence that they were variable. And this raised questions about the extreme physics, the extreme concentrations of radiation, etc. And some of my first papers were really on that.
And that was a very difficult problem to work on in the wake of Martin Schmidt's discoveries and the press they got. And it took many years for the realization to come that active galactic nuclei were really similar objects, perhaps in many cases viewed from different angles.
That's right. It's a contrast, actually, with other important developments. As I said, the microwave background was accepted by nearly everyone within a year as being evidence of the Big Bang. When pulsars were discovered, within a year, everyone had the picture that they were neutron stars made in supernovae. But in the case of quasars, it took a very long time before the consensus emerged. I think the problem was that people had not studied sufficiently other active galaxies. Seyfert galaxies had been known for decades. But people didn't really study them well enough to understand what they were doing. If they knew more about Seyfert galaxies, which had a compact nucleus that was non-stellar, then they would, I suspect, have realized that if you just turned up the wick of a Seyfert galaxy, you would get something which outshined the rest of the galaxy and could therefore have to be seen at great distances, where you just saw what looked, in effect, a point of light. But it didn't happen that way, as you say, and it was really at least 10 years before there was a consensus that quasars were some central object, almost certainly a black hole.
Very complex and difficult problem to be working on. And you also then, you had postdoctoral positions at a variety of places, including Cambridge and at Berkeley and Princeton as well.
Yes, well, here again, I was lucky. I got a post in Cambridge as a postdoc, which allowed me to take leave of absence fairly generously. And I decided, and I think in retrospect, this was a wise decision, that I would go for 6 months to Caltech, one year, and then the next year I went for 6 months to Princeton Institute, and those were both exciting and formative experiences, which developed my range of interests and gave me the chance to meet and work with people in the U.S.
And then you had a professorship at Sussex University, and thereafter went back to Cambridge and became a fellow at King's College, and that was that 1973, I believe?
Yes, I had this short-term position in Cambridge. I knew I had to move, and I got appointed just before I was 30 to a professorship at Sussex University, which was a fairly newly established university, which was near to Hurstmonceux, which is where the Royal Greenwich Observatory had moved to. So for that reason, they decided that although they were a fairly small university, they would have a department of astronomy. They had appointed initially a very distinguished professor, William McCrae, and when he retired, there was a vacancy, and I was appointed to that. And I was very happy to go there. But as it turned out, I wasn't there very long because Fred Hoyle resigned rather prematurely at Cambridge. And to my surprise, I was offered the post as his successor. So after only a year at Sussex, I was appointed to the senior chair in Cambridge and moved back there. And I've been based at Cambridge. There were lots of absences ever since then in various capacities.
Including being the director of the Institute for Astronomy at Cambridge.
Well, that's right, because the Institute was established about the time I first went there. I did a stint as director, indeed, for the first 20 years of the Institute of Astronomy. Donald Lyndon Bell, who was a somewhat senior person to me, and I alternated. So we each did about 9 years, two spells of 4 or 5 years as director. It was a fairly small institution then. It's grown a lot under subsequent directors, and now we have about 70 staff and postdocs and about 70 students.
After coming back to Cambridge and with all of the interesting personalities that you were involved with and the amazing research, you've been involved in a tremendous number of really absorbing areas of astronomy and astrophysics. One of them that's currently a really interesting area is the early history of matter in the universe and the formation of the first stars, the first galaxies, the black holes, the sequence of that which came after the Dark Age. That's a really challenging problem now that, that we're grappling with, isn't it?
Absolutely. And, of course, part of the history is that the redshifts that we could observe have been going up. They were, of course, extended when we found quasars. There was a redshift of 2, I remember, back in about 1965. And we now have objects with redshifts of 7 for quasars and even more for galaxies. So we now have evidence for what the universe was like back to when it was about a tenth of its age. And we are looking back to a stage when we think galaxies were only just forming. And, of course, the other thing that's happened, and this really happened in the 1980s, was the realization that dark matter was important and the development of the cold dark matter model of the universe. And I think one of the great triumphs of the subject is that this model works very well. We know that the universe started off with the radiation and atoms at about 5 times as much mass in some sort of mysterious neutral particles as there was in the atoms themselves. And as the universe expanded, then the clustering involved the dark matter and the ordinary atoms. And this picture gives a pretty good model for how galaxies evolved. And the main reason it's so convincing is that the initial fluctuations, which are the seeds for the galaxies, are now directly observed. The microwave background, of course, which was only observed crudely in the early days, has now been observed by WMAP and Planck spacecraft, so we know the details of the fluctuations. And what is a wonderful success of the theory is that if you start off your computer with the fluctuations which are observed by Planck and then run it forward, then you end up with structures in the universe resembling what we see. And that says we're on the right lines. And the story seems to be that the first objects formed on a scale smaller than the galaxy, probably about a million solar masses or so, and that happened when the universe was maybe 200 or 300 million years old. Mm-hmm. And then these small systems aggregated into galaxies, and we are able to see some of these very early galaxies. But another important thing that happened in the universe was at some stage, which corresponds to the region about six, the intergalactic gas, which of course had been cool and neutral ever since the universe cooled below 3,000 degrees, got heated up and ionized again. And this is something which you can easily detect by looking at quasar spectra. And this happened at a redshift of about six, that's when the universe was about 8 billion years old. And a lot of interest now is in trying to understand how the lights turned on, as it were, when the ionization happened, and how it happened. Was it caused by quasars, by a generation of O and B stars, etc.? We don't quite know, but that's a very important area. So what we are trying to understand is the transition between the rather dull universe, which was cold and dark, with no nonlinear fluctuations, to the complex universe, when the first stars and galaxies formed, lots of feedback and getting very complicated. And the fact that we can observe very distant galaxies helps, and to be big steps forward when we have the next generation of instruments, when the James Webb telescope can observe in infrared, perhaps find galaxies at a redshift of 10, and also when the Square Kilometre Array is able to map the hydrogen, because neutral hydrogen, which applies to most of the hydrogen at these very high redshifts, emits the famous 21 centimetre line, and so you can do a sort of tomography of the universe. And so when we have the SKA, which I'm afraid won't be for 10 years, it'll be possible to actually study in detail how the universe changed from being structureless and cold to being full of structures and heated up.
And this is a very great illustration, in my mind, I believe, with a challenge that we have with people who are interested in astronomy, who have not been to school formally, but are bright people, but they're interested in astronomy as an enthusiast activity. And there's so much of this reaction that one hears sometimes of, well, we don't know the precise details of exactly what dark matter is. We don't really have a clue about dark energy yet. So therefore, what good are any of our thoughts? That's not the right mode of thinking truly scientifically. There's a tremendous array of evidence and history of evidence for the cold dark matter model, is there not?
Well, there is, and fortunately the details of how it affects galaxies don't depend on the exact nature of the particles. All they depend on is that the particles are neutral and don't interact with each other, so they swarm rather than behave like a gas. And what's important is the total mass of them all together, mm-hmm. which is a product of how many there are and the mass of each one. And it's that product which is important, which says how important they are in the universe. But it doesn't make any difference to the way galaxies would form, whether these objects are 10 to the minus 3 grams or 10 to the minus 9 grams each.
Yes, yes. You've also done a tremendous amount of interesting research on black holes, and there's a lot going on with them now. What's the sort of state-of-the-art picture in your mind of black holes at various scales, if you would, what we know about them and the allure? There are few subjects in the minds of astronomy enthusiasts, of course, that are as arresting as black holes.
Well, of course, it was only in the 1960s that people realized that Einstein's theory predicted black holes, and at that time people understood their structure and they developed the realization that black holes were fairly standardized objects, that they had a mass, they had a spin, but no other parameters. This was the discovery that goes under the name black holes have no hair. So they're fairly standardized objects, mm-hmm. and we have the equations for space and time around them. And what is wonderful is that we now know that these objects exist. And there are two categories that we firmly know exist. One is that they exist as the endpoint of the evolution of some massive stars, some supernovae give neutron stars, some give black holes, and so we know there are probably a million black holes in our Milky Way. They're hard to detect except when they're in a binary system, because if they're isolated, they don't give out any light. But in a binary system, of course, they capture gas from their surroundings, and that swirls down and gets very hot. And this gives you a class of X-ray sources. And the first of these was discovered in about 1971, Cygnus X-1.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the other class of black holes is the much more massive ones that exist in the centers of galaxies. And these are the ones which were inferred to exist by the observations of quasars. And in fact, it was my senior colleague, Don Lyndon Bell, who gave the first very clear arguments back in 1969 that massive black holes in the centers of galaxies were the relics of quasar activity.
Mm-hmm.
But since that time, we've understood the physics of gas and magnetic fields orbiting around a black hole. And also, we've got a lot of evidence that almost all big galaxies have black holes in their center, and the proportion of the mass of the galaxy in the black hole is fairly standardized. And how it got there, of course, is an important clue. And we can observe lots of phenomena around black holes, disks, jets coming out, and this is what gives rise to many of the phenomena we associate with active galaxies: radio emission, variable optical emission, X-rays, and gamma rays.
And we know simply from the number of galaxies in the universe that there must be trillions of black holes of various masses, at least.
That's right. We know that in every galaxy there is a black hole. Well, in the smallest galaxies, we're not sure. Most big galaxies have one. And we also know that there are black holes in galaxies as a remnant of stars. And, of course, what we don't altogether know is whether the black holes have exactly the properties that Einstein's theory predicts, because we know that they're generically some sort of a hole in space that stuff can fall into, but where they have the exact metric, which was discovered by Roy Kerr, a New Zealand theorist, in 1964, and which you now realize is the metric which is quite universal, that isn't really confirmed. It's supported by the evidence, but we don't have strong evidence for it. One thing that would really help would be if we could detect gravitational radiation, because this is an effect which just depends on gravity in space and time, no complications from electromagnetism. But this is very hard to detect. The best candidates for producing detectable gravitational waves would be pairs of black holes which are merging. Mm-hmm. And this sometimes happens because we know that galaxies merge. And when galaxies merge, then they end up forming a big elliptical galaxy. And if each had a black hole in it, then those two black holes will sink towards the center and then feel each other's gravity and form a binary. And gradually the binary will dissipate energy and get closer, and it'll finally merge. And about 10% of its rest mass energy will come out in a gravitational wave pulse. Now, that's very hard to detect, but there are attempts being made to do that.
And you've done quite a bit of work thinking about gravitational waves. I love the title of Kip Thorne's talk at the first Starmus, that gravitational waves, the brightest objects in the universe, but no light.
Absolutely, and they're very hard to detect, even if they put out far more energy than the light. And Kip Thorne has been the promoter of what's called LIGO, which is a set of interferometers, and that is going to be looking for the stellar mass black holes, the small ones. They're actually harder to detect than the big ones. In order to detect the coalescence of the big black holes, we've got to wait till there's a satellite or a group of satellites. And there was a very exciting project called LISA, mm-hmm. Laser Interferometer in Space, which was originally a joint NASA-ESA project. But then sadly, NASA dropped out. Yeah. It had to be de-scoped and delayed. And it'll be a long time before that ever flies. But if that can fly, then that will detect these coalescences of massive black holes and will detect even binary white dwarfs and all kinds of things. That's because it works at lower frequencies. periods of about one cycle per hour, much slower than the sorts of frequencies LIGO is looking for.
And it's possible that LISA may go something on the order of a decade from now, roughly?
Well, I think even that's optimistic. If the Americans came back in, and if there are any people listening to this who have influence with NASA, it would be great if they came back in and joined with ESA so we could revive LISA rather than the Europeans by themselves doing a experiment which will have to be scaled down a bit.
Yes, yeah. Now let's talk about, we've had a lot, of course, all amateur astronomers love to wonder about the possibilities, hypothetically, of falling into or traveling through a black hole, either stellar mass or supermassive black hole. We've had movies made about that recently, of course. What's your take on the realism of what gravitational, what would happen to a human being traveling into a black hole?
Well, we certainly know that if they traveled into a black hole weighing as much as, say, 10 suns, the kind of black hole which exists in profusion in our galaxy, then before you got anywhere near the black hole, you'd be torn apart because the gravitational pull between your head and your feet would be enough to tear you apart. This is called spaghettification.
Yeah.
on the other hand, if you fall into one of the very big black holes, then you pass the point of no return, the horizon of the black hole, when the tidal gravitational force is still fairly gentle. So you'd be okay, you won't feel anything special, but you then have entered an arena from which you can never return, and you can't send back any messages, so it's no good me sending a student because he can't send back any messages for that part. So we know that. And of course, going into science fiction, then the question is whether the person who falls into a big black hole eventually does get spaghettified or squashed in a so-called singularity. That's the most likely thing, but there are some possibilities that you could escape the singularity if you fall into a spinning black hole and emerge into a separate space-time. This is not impossible. In fact, one of my contemporaries as a research student, Brandon Carter, who was the first person to think about all the consequences of Roy Kerr's solution, he speculated about that, but we don't know if it's possible.
But it's fascinating, as you mentioned, that with a supermassive black hole, you could pass into the event horizon or across the event horizon and not even realize it, potentially.
Absolutely, because the tidal force gets stronger, but it's not very strong. And incidentally, one subject which is attracting a lot of interest now is something which I worked on about 25 years ago, and that's what happens to a star if it gets very close to one of these big black holes. Does the star get torn apart, or does the star go inside without any conspicuous display? And here again, this is interesting, and there have been some recent evidences that there are flares in the centers of galaxies which are probably caused by a star which gets close to a black hole but gets tidally torn apart before it can fall in. And then you get a sort of sudden outburst, sudden flare, and a sudden amount of material dumped on the black hole. And there's a lot of debate now about exactly what the appearance would be of this. It's a quite complicated thing to compute, but this is of great interest. And there are some candidate objects which are almost certainly to be explained this way.
You've also worked extensively and written about the origin and the evolution of the universe, of course, cosmology, the fate of the cosmos. Where are we now? Are we really leaning heavily toward a big freeze outcome for the whole shooting match here, do you think?
Well, of course, what's been discovered in the last 15 years is that the expansion of the universe is actually speeding up because there is this extra force latent in empty space, which is sometimes called dark energy, which is quite unimportant in the galaxy, but in intergalactic space, which is so dilute, this repulsive force latent in space overwhelms gravity and causes the expansion to speed up rather than to slow down. And of course, the most natural consequence of that is that the universe will get ever colder, ever emptier, and will go on forever to the big freeze. But long-range forecasts are never completely reliable, and particularly in this case, when we don't understand the dark energy, we can't be sure. So we can't absolutely rule out that there might be a big crunch where everything collapses. In fact, right back in 1969, one of my first papers was actually on what would happen if the universe re-collapsed.
Mm.
And because at that time, we didn't know what the density of the universe was, and it was quite popular to believe the universe was closed and finite and would stop expanding and re-collapse. And it was rather interesting that I realized that if the universe re-collapsed, you might think that the stars would start colliding with each other, but the first thing that would discomfort the stars during the collapse would be that they'd find that the night sky, due to the heating of the microwave background as it was compressed again, would be hotter than their surface. The stars couldn't radiate because there'd be more heat from outside trying to get in than heat from the star trying to get out.
Mm-hmm.
So the stars would be destroyed by the fact that they would be, as it were, in an oven that got hotter and hotter. And so that's an interesting consequence if the universe re-collapses. But although we can't rule that out, the best bet is on an ever-expanding universe.
Yes. What is your feeling now about the subject of multiple universes, of multiverses, the mathematical plausibility, the fact that likely we would never have any real empirical evidence? Where does that go in your mind now in terms of solidity as something that cosmologists can research or at least talk about mathematically?
Well, of course, we don't know that they exist, but I think it's a serious issue at the moment. The reason we don't know is that when we think about the early universe, the Big Bang, we can extrapolate back a certain way, but no further. As we extrapolate further back, then everything gets hotter and denser. When the universe was 1 second old, it would be at about 10 billion degrees, and that's when the hydrogen to helium ratio is fixed, and we can understand that. We can probably go back to about a nanosecond. That's when each particle in the universe would have about the same energy as you can produce in the LHC particle accelerator at CERN in Geneva. But when you get back before that, all bets are off, really, because we don't know what the physics would be because it's beyond the range we can test experimentally here on Earth. Nonetheless, many people suspect that you won't understand why the universe is expanding the way it is, why it contains the observed mix of atoms and radiation and dark matter, and where the fluctuations came from, unless we go right back to about a trillionth of a trillionth of a trillionth of a second, 10 to the minus 36 seconds. And that's a time when everything in the observable universe would be squeezed down to the size of a tennis ball and extreme physics. And that is the era where many people suspect there's a period of inflation takes place, when there's a very fast expansion, which could, by a very, very beautiful theory, could give rise to the universe expanding the way it is. Now, there are lots of ideas about the physics of inflation. And they're all uncertain, but some of them have the consequence that you wouldn't get just one Big Bang. You get Big Bangs popping off in a sort of infinite ensemble, and this has been worked out over nearly three decades now by André Linde in particular at Stanford, and this is what's called eternal inflation. And this is at least a particular model which would give rise to multiple Big Bangs. We don't know if it's right because although Linde can say what the physics would have to be in order to give this eternal inflation, we don't know whether that's right physics. We mm-hmm. might one day learn by indirect methods what the physics is of these energies. And if we learned that it had those properties, then we'd have to take the multiverse idea seriously, even though we couldn't observe the other Big Bangs. It's often said that it's not part of science to talk about unobservable things, but that's not quite true. Let's give an example. I was talking earlier about what happens inside a black hole. We can't observe inside black holes, but we can have some confidence that we know what happens inside a black hole where we can't observe, because we've tested Einstein's theory in other places where we can observe it. And so what you need is a theory that's gained credibility by being tested a number of ways, And then you will believe what it says, even in other contexts where you can't directly make observations. And so if we got to that state in the future with regard to the physics of the inflationary era, we might know whether we could with confidence predict that there are many big bangs rather than one. And then there's another very interesting question, which is, if there are many big bangs, are they all replicas of ours?
Mm.
Or do they cool down differently with different physics, governed by different laws, with different strengths of gravity, different particles in them, etc.?
Mm-hmm.
And many string theorists suspect that, because string theorists suspect that the so-called vacuum state, which determines the laws of microphysics, would be very different in other big bangs. And so they would have different physics, and some of them would be sterile or stillborn. They wouldn't allow complexity to emerge. They wouldn't allow the chain of complexity that gave rise in our universe to atoms, stars, galaxies, and planets, and then eventually life to happen.
Mm-hmm.
So the speculation which one is then led to is that there are many big bangs, most of them sterile, and we are not in a typical one. We're in a typical member of the subset which has sufficient tuning of the laws to allow complexity to develop. And this is called anthropic reasoning, and that makes some physicists foam at the mouth. So it means that they're further away from actually being able to discover exact formulae, because if you take this picture, then what we think of as the laws of nature and the constants of nature aren't truly universal. They apply just in our cosmic patch, the region we can see with our telescopes, but this would be just then a tiny part of physical reality. There'd be some deeper underlying laws that would govern the whole of physical reality, but what we call the fundamental laws would just be parochial bylaws in our patch, as it were. And some people don't like that because it means we're further away from having the final picture and equations you could write on your T-shirt to describe the universe. But on the other hand, I think it's a rather wonderful and grand conception that on this huge scale, far bigger than the universe we can observe, things get complicated again, almost like biology with a whole lot of emergent structures.
Mm, fantastic.
I should say, a sort of health warning I should have given, that this is deeply speculative, but I would claim it's speculative science not metaphysics. And when one thinks of how far we've got in the last 50 years, from a time when we didn't know the Big Bang at all to a time when we could talk seriously about its detailed properties back to a nanosecond, then it's not absurd to think that in the next 50 years we will actually understand the nature of the Big Bang to an extent that we can actually decide if there was a multiverse or not, if we're part of a multiverse, or if our Big Bang is unique. And I think we should be open-minded at the moment. It may not be what we like, but we have to live with the way the universe actually is.
But that's a critical principle that you made a very good argument for, and that's don't underestimate the implications from observations in our universe about such a thing as this.
That's right. Our universe may give clues to whether there is a multiverse or not.
Yes.
And of course, that's just an extension of one of the main reasons why we do astronomy and why astronomy is funded. It's because it's a way in which we can learn about the fundamental laws of nature under extreme conditions, which we could never simulate in the lab. We could never build an accelerator powerful enough to produce particles of the kind we see in the cosmic rays and in gamma ray bursts and extreme situations like that. So we learn about extreme physics by astronomical observations and from cosmology.
Excellent, excellent. You've also done some work on the nuclei of galaxies, stepping back to a more solid citizen of the universe. And thankfully, we're not in the nucleus of our galaxy. Things are a little too exciting there, perhaps.
Right.
But talk a little bit, if you would, about why the central regions of galaxies are so interesting and there's so much going on within them.
Well, when a galaxy forms, then the first thing that happens is the dark matter aggregates into a swarm of particles with a concentrated center. and then the gas gradually falls in, and most of it turns into stars. But some of the gas will sink right into the center, form a concentration of gas that might not turn into stars, but might turn into something much bigger. And this is how perhaps the big black holes in the centers of galaxies form. And when we observe the centers of galaxies, we do see all these phenomena, strong radio emission, jets coming out at nearly the speed of light, and strong X-ray emission and rapid variability. Our own galactic center, of course, is known to contain a black hole of about 4 million solar masses. And this can be inferred by following the orbits of stars going around it, some with periods as short as about 10 years. And so we know there's this concentrated mass there. It's actually not very active. There's a very weak radio source right there, but there's reasons to suspect that it has been more active in the past. It was once perhaps a mini quasar. It may actually have periodic burps, which give rise to an outburst. There's some evidence for big bubbles around the galactic center, which some people say are a relic of some activity a million years ago when the fueling of the black hole in the galactic center was higher than it is now.
The so-called Fermi bubbles.
Right.
That's fantastic, and it's a very nice thing to study. There's so much going on in the centers of galaxies, but it's nice to study this, in our case, from 27,000 light years. You've had so many professorships, you've given so many lectures, you've produced so many projects, Lord Rees, in so many places. What are some of your favorite experiences that stand out in your career as an astronomer?
Well, I've worked on a fairly broad front in the different branches of astronomy. And, you know, I go to conferences on different fields, and I may be the only person going to conferences in all three of those different fields, you know. Mm-hmm. They're specialized than most people. But as a consequence, I'm perhaps shallower than other people who would be more specialized. And I think I would enjoy most, and do enjoy most, being part of an ongoing debate. It's been wonderful to see how ideas have clarified all the issues which were being debated when I was a postdoc, or not all, but most of them have been settled by now. And the questions we're now posing couldn't even have been posed back then.
Mm-hmm.
And so these frontiers advance, but as the frontiers advance, new questions come into focus, and the periphery gets longer, so there are more new problems to think about. And I just enjoy being part of this enterprise, and enjoying being active in the community for all too long now.
And given the incredibly rich range of research and of discoveries happening now, it's mind-numbing compared to, say, a couple of generations ago. Would you have any advice to prospective young astronomers getting into this field now?
Well, if they want to do theoretical work, I would certainly advise that they become adept at computer modeling. Because one reason I feel a bit of a dinosaur in the subject I've worked in the past is that until 10 years ago, computers couldn't really do realistic enough modeling to tell us much, whereas now they can. And problems like black hole collisions, stars falling into black holes can now be computed. And the best understanding we will get will be by studying what's done in the virtual world of our computers, as it were. So I would encourage young people who want to study phenomena like that, kind of which I studied, to get adept at computing, because the kind of simple models which were the best that could be done when I was starting research are now not good enough. We've got much better data and we can do much better. So I would advise them to do computer modeling and become expert in that. As regards subjects, I think it would be important to pick a subject where things are happening fast, new things are happening. And also, there's a matter of personality and taste. Do you like to be in a large group or to work alone or with a small group? Because many projects now, of course, are large. They're not quite so quasi-industrial as working at CERN, but of course, if you're involved in a space project or a large survey project, then you're part of a big team. And you may not find it so easy to make an individual mark, which is appreciated by the community. So I think some people prefer to work in a field where things are just starting and where it hasn't got to the stage of requiring big teams. And probably if you look around the subject now, the best area for that is extrasolar planets, because that's a field that only has existed for essentially 20 years and where things are developing fast. And a lot of the work is done on modest-sized telescopes by small groups. That will eventually become big science, but now that's an example of an exciting subject where you don't need to be in a big group. And, of course, if you're a theorist, you can do the kind of problems which are more mathematical and don't need computers. If you do fucking relativity, for instance, you can do that. So the good thing about the subject is that there's a choice of topics, a choice of specialities, which covers all the range. You can decide how much maths you want, how much physics you want, how much computing you want, and whether you want to be in a big team or whether you want to be a no-no or working with just a few colleagues. So that's the important choice people should make, I think.
Terrific. Talk a little bit, if you would, Lord Rees, about your role as Astronomer Royal. That is a title and a situation that fascinates those of us, especially who are not British. But if you would talk a little bit about that, and of course we all know the greats from the past, and you're a direct link to them in that lineage. What is that like, and what does that role entail?
Well, it's now a sort of anachronistic title with no duties, really. I like to say that the duties are so exiguous that I can do them posthumously. I die. But more seriously, of course, the title goes back to 1675. It was a title given to the director of the Royal Observatory.
Yes.
Which was set up at that time.
John Flamsteed.
Well, right, indeed, yes. And then Halland and others.
Yes.
It continued to have those obligations until about the 1950s. But that was when Greenwich ceased to be a active observatory, became a museum, and telescopes moved away, and he started using overseas telescopes. What happened then was that the title was kept. It was given as a sort of honorary title, like Poet Laureate, to a senior astronomer, generally working in the university. And Martin Bile, the great radio astronomer,
yes,
was the first new style astronomer royal, who was honorary, and I'm in that category. So it's a sort of anachronistic, but it does have these historic connotations, of course. And the fact that there is a title called Astronomer Royal, whereas there isn't a Physicist Royal or Chemist Royal, tells us something which is important for our subject, namely that astronomy was the first subject to use big instruments and to be professionalized.
Mm-hmm.
That's why it has this antique title, whereas certainly in this country, in the US, National Physical Laboratories weren't set up until the 19th century, and National Chemical Laboratories also. So the first publicly supported physicists and chemists date from the 19th century, whereas first professional astronomers go back to the 17th century, and that's true not only in the UK, but in France and Italy in particular.
Yes.
So it's a symptom of the fact that astronomy is indeed the first science to use precision instruments and to have professionals. Well, of course, you might say this about medicine as well, which had professionals, but they didn't have instruments. And I like to say that astronomy may not be the oldest science, but it was probably the first to do more good than harm.
Yes, very, very nice. You've also been very involved in co-founding the Center for the Study of Existential Risk. And you've also written a lot about risks to humanity, both from outside Earth, outside this planet, and from what's happening with our civilization or not happening. And this is really an incredibly important area. It obviously is directly involved with some astronomical subjects, but it's a bigger, broader more humanistic subject as well. Would you talk a little bit about the center and about some of the writings and what you feel are risks that humanity should perhaps embrace more than it now does?
Yes, well, this is a sideline I've had for 20 or more years. I mean, I was involved in nuclear disarmament campaigns in the 1980s and thought about other kinds of risks subsequently. And I wrote a book about 13 years ago, which in the UK was published as Our Final Century, and in America was called Our Final Hour.
Yes, which says something about America, but in both cases it got a lot of eyes and grabbed a lot of headlines for good reason.
Well, and what it did was it emphasized that this century is special. I mean, as we know as astronomers, the Earth's existed for 45 million centuries, but this is the first time when one species, namely ours, can really affect the whole planet's fate. And there are really two classes of threats. One is the ones we're imposing collectively on the biosphere and the climate, because there are more of us on the world and we're all more demanding of resources. And the second kind is that technology is getting so powerful that even a few people, through cyber error, cyber terror, or bio error, bioterror, could have a global effect. And this is a new kind of threat. And there aren't very many people thinking about this. Lots of people are thinking about conventional threats. And so that's why I felt it was worthwhile to devote a bit of energy to set up a group which now exists in Cambridge to study these. And there are other activities at Oxford and at MIT and a few other places now. But still, I think there aren't that many people thinking about these extreme risks, which are perhaps not very probable, but their consequences are so great that we ought to worry about them. And a small number of people thinking about this area, I think, will earn their keep if they can reduce the risk by, say, one part in a million, because the stakes are so high. And so that's what we're trying to do. Of course, when people know I'm an astronomer, they think I must worry about asteroid risks, and I do indeed think about asteroid risks, which we can, of course, deal with in the long run. But the difference is that the probability of an asteroid impact is no greater for us than it was for the Neanderthals or even the dinosaurs. And we can quantify that quite well. And we have lots of data on the number of asteroids. Whereas these new risks are those that have only emerged through technology. And they're getting bigger all the time, and we're not so sure we can handle them. And these are much higher risks, because to take an example, the risk of being killed by an asteroid is probably about one in 10 million per year. Whereas during the Cold War, the chances of being killed by a nuclear exchange were probably about at least one in 10, because there might have been a nuclear war by a miscalculation during the Cuba crisis or something like that. And that was a far more serious threat than anything from asteroids. And now we may not be so worried about nuclear war, though it's a threat just in abeyance rather than having gone away, but we need to worry more about misuse of other 21st century technologies. But as regards asteroids, I am, as you mentioned at the beginning, I'm a supporter of the B612 project and other ways in which we can perhaps track all the asteroids so that we can at least be aware of any that are potentially Earth-crossing, in the hope that within 20 or 30 years we'd have the technology to deflect any that might be heading for us.
Yeah, and let's talk in a moment, if we can, about Asteroid Day specifically, which you're involved with as well, and I am as well. But before we go there, if we may, what do we do to get people who are interested and who care, and you know perhaps more than anyone else on the planet about these risks, but what about the intellectually aware, curious people who are in a position to do something? Is there a way for individual folks to help out with this in an age when the people who are in control and potentially in control, politically and otherwise, we've got a situation that's relatively ridiculous. at least in the United States. So is there, do you see hope for educating people in a much richer way, which is certainly lacking in a lot of cases, and pulling together to really do something about these risks to humanity?
Well, I think being aware of them is a start. It's good to actually make people aware. But the things that I think are the most intractable are risks of bio-error or bio-terror, because the technology that's needed for biohacking, etc., is widespread, small-scale, dual use, and there are bound to be lots of errors, even if there's not an intentional attack.
Mm-hmm.
And it's going to be very hard to control that, because it's not like making an H-bomb where you need huge conspicuous facilities. These can be done in a university laboratory, perhaps.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's going to be hard. So there's going to be a real tension, I think, between security and privacy and liberty as that technology advances. The other classes of threats where we are despoiling the planet through affecting the biosphere and the climate change potential and all that, there I think the problem is that in the political debate, the immediate trumps the long term, and mm-hmm. the local trumps the global.
Mm-hmm.
Climate change is especially hard to get up the agenda, because the downside is going to affect people in remote parts of the world more than people in Britain or America,
mm-hmm.
and that downside is only going to get really serious in more than 50 years' time. And so it's very hard to persuade people to put up money for a global insurance policy when the risk is more than 50 years in the future. So mm-hmm. that's very hard. But I think it's gratifying that young people, perhaps unsurprisingly, are more energized about these issues. And so I hope that the generation who are now of student age will gradually be prepared to give more priority to ensuring that we don't cause these irreversible damages to the planet, excessive warming and mass extinctions, etc. So I think raising awareness is helpful, and I think the younger generation are going to be more sensitized to these questions than their elders. I hope so, anyway.
No doubt about that. I think everywhere you're absolutely right about that, and perhaps it's just something that we need another generation to pass before that becomes the norm, the real deep caring about all these issues. But getting back to Asteroid Day, you were involved with Grig and with Brian May and with others in announcing Asteroid Day, and you've been involved in that effort. Where are we with near-Earth asteroid research, and can Asteroid Day continue to help us bringing more attention to a more thorough survey of NEOs?
Well, I think it's raising awareness of this. And, of course, I should say we shouldn't exaggerate the threat. It's,
yes.
It's not the biggest threat. It doesn't keep me awake at night. But nonetheless, if you do plausible estimates, it's a threat that's big enough to be worth maybe a few $100 million a year
mm-hmm.
as insurance premium.
Mm-hmm.
That's, you can give arguments why that's a reasonable amount, and that's far more than is being spent now. There are a couple of satellite projects that would aim to actually survey the brightest or the nearest million asteroids. That's all the ones down to about 50 meters across that might pose a threat. And one could do a lot with ground-based telescopes. I mean, the LSST telescope
mm-hmm.
is going to be very important in this way. I think there's a feeling that it's at least worth doing a more complete survey so that we know the orbits of, say, a million potentially Earth-crossing objects rather than about 50,000, which is all we know at the moment.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And at the same time, there are clever ideas about how we could deflect one of them if it was on a collision course. We do that by a little nudge to its orbit a decade or more before it's likely to impact. Mm-hmm. So I think it's a topic which is worth spending more on than is being done now, and the technology is now available to do this. So I'm very glad there is this growing interest, and that's why I support Asteroid Day. But of course, it's the most quantifiable of the risks, because we actually know roughly how many asteroids there are.
Yes, indeed. And if listeners would like to know more about Asteroid Day, they can go to asteroidday.org to learn all about that project and the awareness there. Thanks so much, Martin, for Lord Rees, for being with us today. And I've really enjoyed it. We've covered a lot of territory. I just wonder, as a sort of a closing thought, is it worthwhile to reflect on, this is really a special era to be interested in astronomy because of the incredibly rapid pace of the evolution of our knowledge.
Absolutely. I think the 1960s, when I was starting, were exciting for the reasons we discussed, the first evidence for the Big Bang, black holes, neutron stars. But if we think of what's been happening in the last decade about really understanding the microwave background fluctuations, gamma ray bursts, exosolar planets, and all that, it's really exciting. And also we know that there are exciting prospects from the next generation of telescopes, not only James Webb, but of course we hope there'll be at least 3 30-meter class telescopes operating a decade from now, the SKA, and all these telescopes are going to hugely expand the amount of data we have and the sensitivity of our observations, and there'll be other space probes to study the X-rays and gamma rays, we hope. And another thing which I think is important is that there can be more citizen participation in these projects, because the data can be downloaded and accessed, and far more people can join in. The range of projects where citizens can make contribution is growing, and I admire particularly my friend Chris Lintott, who was a pioneer of Galaxy Zoo, etc., and is now exploring similar techniques in other areas. And, of course, SETI at Home was an example of this. Mm-hmm. And but before we finish, I could mention that SETI is another thing I'm enthusiastic about, which is an example of something which is unlikely to succeed. But if it did, it's so exciting that it's worth an effort. And it's therefore good news that Yuri Milner has committed $100 million towards an expanded program to search for non-natural radio emissions and also optical emissions, and the program is being headed by Jeff Marcy and his colleagues at Berkeley. But this again, one hopes, will draw in very wide public interest, and I've agreed to chair the advisory committee for the radio searches, and I think it's a great project. But one thing which we have to do, I think, is be open-minded about what might be out there. Maybe nothing, but what we're looking for may not be anything like us. In fact, my guess would be that if we find any signal, it'll come not from anything organic, not from a civilization on a planet, but from some sort of silicon-based huge structure that has been descended from some long-dead civilization, and maybe out in space. Because if we imagine what's going to happen here on Earth, then within a century or two, then there will be robotic fabricators in space, perhaps with human intelligence or more, and they will then develop and replicate, and that's where the future will lie, not with organic materials. So in the timescale of the Earth's history, where there are billions of years in the future, as there were billions in the past, then the interval where you have organic-based technology is only a few centuries. A few centuries that, and there'll be only one more century. But after that, there'll be a billion years when there can be a evolution of the machines. And that therefore means that if there is some other planet on which evolution's taken the course it has on the Earth, then it's most unlikely that it'd be synchronized with us, so that we would see evidence of an organic technology. Far more likely is that if it's ahead of us, we'll see evidence of it's inorganic descendants.
Yes.
So my prediction is if there is any signal, it'll be not a message aimed at us, but it'll be some something which is emitted by one of these machines, either malfunctioning or communicating in some way with others, and we'll have a hard job making sense of it. But any evidence of something artificial will be exciting. But we shouldn't assume it will be like us or indeed a civilization at all. It might just be some huge super brain that doesn't want to be on the planet at all, because for these machines, then being on a planet is not the best place. It might be better to be under zero gravity.
Yes. Yeah. Fantastic. Well, that any detection or a non-detection over long enough time will give us additional great perspective on life on our planet.
And, well, that's right. And of course, non-detection, of course, it may just mean they're out there, but they're not communicating or sending out any signals. But of course, if we are alone, then that's disappointing for the searchers, but it allows us to raise our cosmic self-esteem, because it means that we are not just important to us on this Earth, but we are cosmically important.
Yes.
As the form of life which might eventually populate the galaxy. And so the fate of humans during this century is then of cosmic importance, not just importance to us, because it might make the difference between the galaxy remaining forever sterile and the galaxy being gradually populated by a post-human set of species, both organic and inorganic.
Yes, indeed. Well, thank you so much, Martin Lord Rees, for joining us. It's always a pleasure to talk to you, and you're a brilliant man. Of course, as we all know, it's a great joy for the astronomy readership to be able to listen to you, as well as to enjoy your writings for us and for everyone over time. And so we'll continue to be in touch and carry on with Asteroid Day and other things. And congratulations on everything that you continue to work on.
Well, thank you very much. And it's great that you make the magazine so good every month.
Well, thank you, sir.